lot of good stuff, Terence. Your wife mentioned a company called Dunlane Limited. We've reviewed the files you've already given us. Pretty good material. What else do you know about it?
A lot. Chartered in 1986 with $10 million, which was transferred into the corporation from a numbered account in Banco de Mexico. The same $10 million that arrived in Grand Cayman in cash on a certain Learjet, registered to a quiet little law firm in Memphis, except that it was originally $14 million, but after payoffs to Cayman Customs and Cayman Bankers, it was reduced to $10 million. When the company was chartered, the registered agent was a guy named Diego Sanchez, who happens to be a VP with Banco de Mexico. The president was a delightful soul named Nathan Locke. The secretary was our old pal Royce McKnight, and the treasurer of this cozy little corporation was a guy named Al Rubinstein. I'm sure you know him. I don't. He's a Meralto operative. Surprise, surprise. Want more? Keep talking. After the seed money of $10 million was invested into this venture, another $90 million in cash was deposited over the next 3 years. Very profitable enterprise. The company began buying all sorts of things in the U.S. Cotton farms in Texas, apartment complexes in Dayton, jewelry stores in Beverly Hills, hotels in St. Petersburg and Tampa. Most of the transactions were by wire transfer from four or five different banks in the Caymans. It's a basic money laundering operation. And you've got all this documented? Stupid question, Wayne. If I didn't have the documents, how would I know about it? I only work on clean files, remember? How much longer will it take you?
A couple of weeks. Me and my employee are still snooping around Front Street. And it doesn't look good. It'll be very difficult to get files out of there.
Where'd the 10,000 documents come from?
Mitch ignored the question. He jumped to his feet and started for the door. Abby and I want to live in Albuquerque. It's a big town, sort of out of the way. Start working on it. Don't jump the gun. There's a lot of work to do.
I said 2 weeks, Terence. I'll be ready to deliver in 2 weeks, and that means I'll have to disappear.
Not so fast. I need to see a few of these documents. You have a short memory, Terence. My lovely wife promised a big stack of Dunlane documents just as soon as Ray goes over the wall.
Terence looked across the dark field. I'll see what I can do.
Mitch walked to him and pointed a finger in his face. Listen to me, Terence, and listen closely. I don't think we're getting through. Today is April 17th. 2 weeks from today is May 1st, and on May 1st, I will deliver to you, as promised, over 10,000 very incriminating and highly admissible documents that will seriously cripple one of the largest organized crime families in the world. And eventually, it will cost me my life. But I promised to do it. And you've promised to get my brother out of prison. You have a week until April 24th. If not, I'll disappear. And so will your case and career.
What's he gonna do when he gets out?
You and your stupid questions. He'll run like hell, that's what he'll do. He's got a brother with $1 million who's an expert in money laundering and electronic banking. He'll be out of the country within 12 hours and he'll go find the $1 million.
The Bahamas.
Bahamas. You're an idiot, Terence. That money spent less than 10 minutes in the Bahamas. You can't trust those corrupt fools down there. Mr. Voiles doesn't like deadlines. He gets real upset.
Tell Mr. Voiles to kiss my ass. Tell him to get the next $500,000 because I'm almost ready. Tell him to get my brother out or the deal's off. Tell him whatever you want, Terrence, but Ray goes over the wall in a week or I'm gone. Mitch slammed the door and started down the bleachers. Terrence followed. When do we talk again? He yelled. Mitch jumped the fence and was on the track. My employee will call you. Just do as she says. Chapter 31. Nathan Locke's annual three-day post-April 15th vacation in Vail had been canceled by DeVasher on orders from Lazarov. Locke and Oliver Lambert sat in the office on the fifth floor and listened. DeVasher was reporting the bits and pieces and trying unsuccessfully to put the puzzle together. His wife leaves. Says she's got to go home to her mother, who's got lung cancer. And that she's tired of a bunch of his crap. We've detected a little trouble here and there over the months. She bitched a little about his hours and all, but nothing this serious. So she goes home to Mommy. Says she don't know when she's coming back. Mommy's sick, right? Removed a lung, right? But we can't find a hospital that's heard of Maxine Sutherland. We've checked every hospital in Kentucky, Indiana, and Tennessee. Seems odd, doesn't it, fellas? Come on, DeVasher, Lambert said. My wife had surgery 4 years ago, and we flew to the Mayo Clinic. I know of no law requiring one to have surgery within 100 miles of home. That's absurd. And these are society people. Maybe she checked in under another name to keep it quiet. Happens all the time. Locke nodded and agreed. How much has he talked to her? She calls about once a day. They've had some good talks about this and that. The dog, her mom, the office. She told him last night she ain't coming back for at least 2 months. Has she ever indicated which hospital? Asked Locke. Never. She's been real careful. Doesn't talk much about the surgery. Mommy is supposedly home now, if she ever left. What are you getting at, DeVasher? Asked Lambert. Shut up and I'll finish. Just suppose it's all a ruse to get her out of town, to get her away from us, from what's coming down. Follow? You're assuming he's working with them, asked Locke. I get paid for making those assumptions, Nat. I'm assuming he knows the phones are bugged, and that's why they're so careful on the phone. I'm assuming he got her out of town to protect her. Pretty shaky, said Lambert. Pretty shaky. DeVasher paced behind his desk. He glared at Ollie and let it pass. About 10 days ago, somebody makes a bunch of unusual copies on the fourth floor. Strange, because it was 3 in the morning. According to our records, when the copies were made, only 2 lawyers were here. McDear and Scott Kimball. Neither of whom had any business on the fourth floor. 24 access numbers were used. 3 belonged to Lamar Quinn's files. 3 belonged to Sonny Capps. The other 18 belonged to McDear's files. None belonged to Kimball. Victor Milligan left his office around 2:30, and McDear was working in Avery's office. He had taken him to the airport. Avery says he locked his office, but he could have forgotten. Either he forgot or McDear's got a key. I pressed Avery on this, and he feels almost certain he locked it. But it was midnight, and he was dead tired and in a hurry. Could have forgotten, right? But he did not authorize McDear to go back to his office and work. No big deal, really, because they had spent the entire day in there working on the Caps' return. The copier was number 11, which happens to be the closest one to Avery's office. I think it's safe to assume McDear made the copies. How many? 2012. Which files? The 18 were all tax clients. Now,
I'm sure he'd explain it all by saying he had finished the returns and was merely copying everything. Sounds pretty legitimate, right? Except the secretaries always make the copies. And what the hell was he doing on the fourth floor at 3 a.m. running 2,000 copies? And this was the morning of April 7th. How many of your boys finished their April 15th work and run all the copies a week early? He stopped pacing and watched them. They were thinking. He had them. And here's the kicker. 5 days later, his secretary entered the same 18 access numbers on her copier on the second floor. She ran about 300 copies, which I ain't no lawyer, but I figure to be more in line. Don't you think? They both nodded, but said nothing. They were lawyers, trained to argue five sides of every issue. But they said nothing. Devasher smiled wickedly and returned to his pacing. Now, we caught him making 2,000 copies that cannot be explained. So the big question is, what was he copying? If he was using wrong access numbers to run the machine, what the hell was he copying? I don't know. All of the offices were locked, except, of course, Avery's. So I asked Avery. He's got a row of metal cabinets where he keeps the real files. He keeps them locked, but he and McDear and the secretaries have been rummaging through those files all day. Could have forgot to lock them when he ran to meet the plane. Big deal. Why would McDear copy legitimate files? He wouldn't. Like everybody else on the fourth floor, Avery's got those four wooden cabinets with the secret stuff. No one touches them, right? Firm rules. Not even other partners. Locked up tighter than my files. So McDear can't get in without a key. Avery showed me his keys. Told me he hadn't touched those cabinets in 2 days before the 7th. Avery has gone through those files and everything seems in order. He can't tell if they've been tampered with. But can you look at one of your files and tell if it's been copied? No, you can't. Neither can I. So I pulled the files this morning, and I'm sending them to Chicago. They're going to check them for fingerprints. Take about a week. He couldn't copy those files, Lambert said. What else would he copy, Ollie? I mean, everything's locked on the fourth floor and the third floor. Everything. Except Avery's office. And assuming he and Terrence are whispering in each other's ears, what would he want from Avery's office? Nothing but the secret files. Now you're assuming he's got keys, Locke said. Yes, I'm assuming he's made a set of Avery's keys. Ollie snorted and gave an exasperated laugh. This is incredible. I don't believe it. Black eyes glared at Devasher with a nasty smile. How would he get a copy of the keys? Good question, and one that I can't answer. Avery showed me his keys. 2 rings, 11 keys. He keeps them with him at all times. Firm rule, right? Like a good little lawyer is supposed to do. When he's awake, the keys are in his pocket. When he's asleep, away from home, the keys are under the mattress. Where's he traveled in the last month? Black Eyes asked. Forget the trip to see Caps in Houston last week. Too recent. Before that, he went to Grand Cayman for 2 days on April 1st. I remember, said Ollie, listening intently. Good for you, Ollie. I asked him what he did both nights, and he said nothing but work. Sat at a bar one night, but that's it. Swears he slept by himself both nights. Devasher pushed a button on a portable tape recorder. But he's lying. This call was made at 9:15, April 2nd, from the phone in the master bedroom of Unit A. The tape began. He's in the shower. First female voice. Are you okay? Second female voice. Yeah, fine. He couldn't do it if he had to.
What took so long? He wouldn't wake up. Is he suspicious?
No. He remembers nothing. I think he's in pain.
How long will you be there?
I'll kiss him goodbye when he gets out of the shower. 10, maybe 15 minutes.
Okay. Hurry.
Devasher punched another button and continued pacing. I have no idea who they are, and I haven't confronted Avery. Yet. He worries me. His wife has filed for divorce, and he's lost control. Chases women all the time. This is a pretty serious breach of security, and I suspect Lazarov will go through the roof.
She talked like it was a bad hangover, Locke said.
Evidently. You think she copied the keys? Ollie asked. Devasher shrugged and sat in his worn leather chair. The cockiness vanished. It's possible, but I doubt it. I've thought about it for hours. Assuming it was some woman he picked up in a bar and they got drunk, then it was probably late when they went to bed. How would she make copies of the keys in the middle of the night on that tiny island? I just don't think so.
But she had an accomplice, Locke insisted.
Yeah, I can't figure that out. Maybe they were trying to steal his wallet and something went wrong. He carries a couple of thousand in cash, and if he got drunk, who knows what he told them. Maybe she planned to lift the money at the last second and haul ass. She didn't do it. I don't know.
No more assumptions? Ollie asked.
Not now. I love to make them, but it goes too far to assume these women took the keys, somehow managed to copy them in the middle of the night on the island, without his knowledge, and then the first one crawled back in the bed with him. And somehow all of this is related to McDear and his use of the copier on the fourth floor. It's just too much.
I agree, said Ollie.
What about the storage room? Asked Black Eyes. I've thought about that, Nat. In fact, I've lost sleep thinking about it. If she was interested in the records in the storage room, there must be some connection with McDear or someone else poking around. And I can't make that connection. Let's say she found the room and the records. What could she do with them in the middle of the night with Avery asleep upstairs?
She could read them?
Yeah. There's only a million. Keep in mind now, she must have been drinking along with Avery or he would have been suspicious. So she spent the night drinking and screwing. She waits until he goes to sleep, then suddenly she has this urge to go downstairs and read bank records. It don't work, boys. She could work for the FBI, Ollie said proudly. No, she couldn't.
Why?
It's simple, Ollie. The FBI wouldn't do it because the search would be illegal and the records would be inadmissible. And there's much better reason.
What?
If she was a fibby, she wouldn't have used the phone. No professional would have made that call. I think she was a pickpocket.
The pickpocket theory was explained to Lazarov, who poked 100 holes but could devise nothing better. He ordered changes in all the locks on the 3rd and 4th floors and the basement, and both condos on Grand Cayman. He ordered a search for all the locksmiths on the island. There couldn't be many, he said, to determine if any had reproduced keys the night of April 1st or the early morning of April 2nd.
Bribe them, he told Devasher. They'll talk for a little money.
He ordered a fingerprint examination of the files from Avery's office.
Devasher proudly explained he had already started this. McDear's prints were on file with the State Bar Association.
He also ordered a 60-day suspension of Avery Tolar. Devasher suggested this might alert McDear to something unusual.
Fine, said Lazarov. Tell Tolar to check into the hospital with chest pains.
2 months off, doctor's orders. Tell Tolar to clean up his act. Lock up his office. Assign McDear to Victor Milligan.
You said you had a good plan to eliminate McDear, Devasher said.
Lazarov grinned and picked his nose.
Yeah. I think we'll use the plane. We'll send him down to the islands on a little business trip, and there will be this mysterious explosion.
Waste two pilots? Asked Devasher.
Yeah. It needs to look good.
Don't do it anywhere around the Caymans. That'll be too coincidental.
Okay, but it needs to happen over water. Less debris. We'll use a big device so they won't find much.
That plane's expensive.
Yeah. I'll run it by Joey first.
You're the boss. Let me know if we can help down there.
Sure.
Start thinking about it.
What about your man in Washington? Devasher asked.
I'm waiting. I called New York this morning, and they're checking into it. We should know in a week.
That would make it easy.
Yeah. If the answer is yes, we need to eliminate him within 24 hours.
I'll start planning.
The office was quiet for a Saturday morning. A handful of partners and a dozen associates loitered about in khakis and polos. There were no secretaries. Mitch checked his mail and dictated correspondence. After 2 hours, he left. It was time to visit Ray. For 5 hours, he drove east on Interstate 40. Drove like an idiot. He drove 45, then 85. He darted into every rest stop and way station. He made sudden exits from the left lane. He stopped at an underpass and waited and watched. He never saw them. Not once did he notice a suspicious car or truck or van. He even watched a few 18-wheelers. Nothing. They simply were not back there. He would have caught them. His care package of books and cigarettes was cleared through the guard station, and he was pointed to stall number 9. Minutes later, Ray sat through the thick screen.
"Where have you been?" he said with a hint of irritation. "You're the only person in the entire world who visits me, and this is only the second time in 4 months."
"I know. It's tax season, and I've been swamped. I'll do better."
"I've written, though."
"Yeah. Once a week I get 2 paragraphs.
Hi, Ray. How's the bunk? How's the food? How are the walls? How's the Greek or Italian?"
"I'm fine. Abby's great. Dog's sick. Gotta run. I'll come visit soon. Love, Mitch."
"You write some rich letters, little brother.
I really treasure them."
"Yours aren't much better."
"What have I got to say?"
"The guards are selling dope. A friend got stabbed 31 times. I saw a kid get raped."
"Come on, Mitch, who wants to hear it?"
"I'll do better."
"How's Mom?"
"I don't know. I haven't been back since Christmas."
"I asked you to check on her, Mitch.
I'm worried about her. If that goon is beating her, I want it stopped. If I could get out of here, I'd stop it myself."
"You will."
It was a statement, not a question. Mitch placed a finger over his lips and nodded slowly. Ray leaned forward on his elbows and stared intently. Mitch spoke softly.
"Español. Hable despacio."
"Spanish. Speak slowly." Ray smiled slightly.
"Cuándo?"
"When?"
"La semana próxima?"
"Next week."
"Qué día?"
"What day?"
Mitch thought for a second.
"Martes o miércoles?"
"Tuesday or Wednesday."
"Qué tiempo?"
"What time?"
Mitch smiled and shrugged and looked around. "How's Abby?" Ray asked.
"She's been in Kentucky for a couple of weeks. Her mother's sick."
He stared at Ray and softly mouthed the words, "Trust me."
"What's wrong with her?"
"They removed a lung. Cancer. She smoked heavy all her life."
"You should quit."
"I will if I ever get out of here." Mitch smiled and nodded slowly.
"You've got at least 7 more years."
"Yeah, and escape is impossible. They try it occasionally, but they're either shot or captured."
"James Earl Ray went over the wall, didn't he?"
Mitch nodded slowly as he asked the question. Ray smiled and watched his brother's eyes.
"But they caught him. They bring in a bunch of mountain boys with bloodhounds, and it gets pretty nasty. I don't think anyone's ever survived the mountains after they got over the wall."
"Let's talk about something else," Mitch said.
"Good idea."
2 guards stood by a window behind the row of visitors' booths. They were enjoying a stack of dirty pictures someone took with a Polaroid and tried to sneak through the guard station. They giggled among themselves and ignored the visitors. On the prisoner's side, a single guard with a stick walked benignly back and forth, half asleep.
"When can I expect little nieces and nephews?" Ray asked.
"Maybe in a few years.
Abby wants one of each, and she would start now if I would."
"I'm not ready."
The guard walked behind Ray, but did not look. They stared at each other, trying to read each other's eyes.
"A donde voy?" Ray asked quickly. "Where am I going?"
"Perdido Beach, Hilton.
We went to the Cayman Islands last month, Abby and I. Had a beautiful vacation."
"Never heard of the place. Where is it?"
"In the Caribbean, below Cuba."
"Que es mi nombre?"
"What is my name?"
"Lee Stevens.
Did some snorkeling.
The water is warm and gorgeous. The firm owns 2 condos right on 7 Mile Beach. All I paid for was the airfare. It was great."
"Give me a book. I'd like to read about it."
"Pasaporte."
Mitch nodded with a smile. The guard walked behind Ray and stopped. They talked of old times in Kentucky. At dusk, he parked the BMW on the dark side of a suburban mall in Nashville. He left the keys in the ignition and locked the door. He had a spare in his pocket. A busy crowd of Easter shoppers moved en masse through the Sears doors. He joined them. Inside, he ducked into the men's clothing department and studied socks and underwear while watching the door. Nobody suspicious. He left Sears and walked quickly through the crowd down the mall. A black cotton sweater in the window of a men's store caught his attention. He found one inside, tried it on, and decided to wear it out of there. He liked it so much. As the clerk laid his change on the counter, he scanned the yellow pages for the number of a cab. Back into the mall, he rode the escalator to the first floor, where he found a payphone. The cab would be there in 10 minutes. It was dark now, the cool, early dark of spring in the south. He watched the mall entrance from inside a singles bar. He was certain he had not been followed through the mall. He walked casually to the cab. "Brentwood," he said to the driver, and disappeared into the back seat. Brentwood was 20 minutes away. "Savannah Creek Apartments," he said. The cab searched through the sprawling complex and found number 480E. He threw a 20 over the seat and slammed the door. Behind an outside stairwell, he found the door to 480E. It was locked. "Who is it?" a nervous female voice asked from within. He heard the voice and felt weak. "Berryer Banks," he said. Abby pulled the door open and attacked.
They kissed violently as he lifted her, walked inside, and slammed the door with his foot. His hands were wild. In less than 2 seconds, he pulled her sweater over her head, unsnapped her bra, and slid the rather loose-fitting skirt to her knees. They continued kissing. With one eye, he glanced apprehensively at the cheap, flimsy, rented fold-a-bed that was waiting. Either that or the floor. He laid her gently on it and took off his clothes. The bed was too short, and it squeaked. The mattress was 2 inches of foam rubber wrapped in a sheet. The metal braces underneath jutted upward and were dangerous. But the McDears did not notice. When it was good and dark, and the crowd of shoppers at the mall thinned for a moment, a shiny black Chevrolet Silverado pickup pulled behind the BMW and stopped. A small man with a neat haircut and sideburns jumped out, looked around, and stuck a pointed screwdriver into the door lock of the BMW. Months later, when he was sentenced, he would tell the judge that he had stolen over 300 cars and pickups in 8 states, and that he could break into a car and start the engine faster than the judge could with the keys. Said his average time was 28 seconds. The judge was not impressed. Occasionally, on a very lucky day, an idiot would leave the keys in the car, and the average time was reduced dramatically. A scout had found this car with the keys. He smiled and turned them. The Silverado raced away, followed by the BMW. The Nordic jumped from the van and watched. It was too fast. He was too late. The pickup just pulled up, blocked his vision for an instant, then wham, the BMW was gone. Stolen. Before his very eyes. He kicked the van. Now, how would he explain this? He crawled back into the van and waited for McDear. After an hour on the couch, the pain of loneliness had been forgotten. They walked through the small apartment holding hands and kissing. In the bedroom, Mitch had his first viewing of what had become known among the three as the Bendini Papers. He had seen Tammy's notes and summaries, but not the actual documents. The room was like a chessboard with rows of neat stacks of papers. On 2 of the walls, Tammy had tacked sheets of white poster board, then covered them with the notes and lists and flowcharts. One day soon he would spend hours in the room, studying the papers and preparing his case. But not tonight. In a few minutes, he would leave her and return to the mall. She led him back to the couch. Chapter 32. The hall on the 10th floor, Madison Wing, of the Baptist Hospital was empty, except for an orderly and a male nurse writing on his clipboard. Visiting hours had ended at 9, and it was 10:30. He eased down the hall, spoke to the orderly, was ignored by the nurse, and knocked on the door. "Come in," a strong voice said. He pushed the heavy door open and stood by the bed. "Hello, Mitch," Avery said. "Can you believe this?" "What happened?" "I woke up at 6 this morning with stomach cramps, I thought. I took a shower and felt a sharp pain right here on my shoulder. My breathing got heavy and I started sweating. I thought, no, not me. Hell, I'm 44, in great shape. Work out all the time. Eat pretty good. Drink a little too much, maybe, but not me. I called my doctor, and he said to meet him here at the hospital. He thinks it was a slight heart attack. Nothing serious, he hopes, but they're running tests for the next few days." "A heart attack?" "That's what he said." "I'm not surprised, Avery. It's a wonder any lawyer in that firm lives past 50. Capps did it to me, Mitch. Sonny Capps. This is his heart attack. He called Friday and said he'd found a new tax firm in Washington. Wants all his records. That's my biggest client.
I billed him almost $400,000 last year, about what he paid in taxes. He's not mad about the attorney's fees, but he's furious about the taxes. It doesn't make sense, Mitch.
He's not worth dying for. Mitch looked for an IV, but did not see one. There were no tubes or wires. He sat in the only chair and laid his feet on the bed.
Jean filed for divorce, you know.
I heard.
That's no surprise, is it? Surprised she didn't do it last year. I've offered her a small fortune as a settlement. I hope she takes it. I don't need a nasty divorce.
Who does? Thought Mitch. What did Lambert say?
It was kind of fun, really. In 19 years, I've never seen him lose his cool. But he lost it. He told me I was drinking too much, chasing women, and who knows what else. Said I had embarrassed the firm. Suggested I see a psychiatrist.
Avery spoke slowly, deliberately, and at times with a raspy, weak voice. It seemed phony. A sentence later, he would forget about it and return to his normal voice. He lay perfectly still, like a corpse, with the sheets tucked neatly around him. His color was good.
I think you need a psychiatrist. Maybe two. Thanks. I need a month in the sun. Doc said he would discharge me in 3 or 4 days and that I couldn't work for 2 months. 60 days, Mitch. Said I cannot, under any circumstances, go near the office for 60 days.
What a blessing. I think I'll have a slight heart attack.
At your pace, it's guaranteed.
What, are you a doctor now?
No. Just scared. You get a scare like this, and you start thinking about things. Today is the first time in my life I've ever thought about dying. And if you don't think about death, you don't appreciate life.
This is getting pretty heavy.
Yeah, I know. How's Abby?
Okay. I guess. I haven't seen her in a while.
You'd better go see her and bring her home and get her happy. 60 hours a week is plenty, Mitch. You'll ruin your marriage and kill yourself if you work more. She wants babies, then get them. I wish I had done things differently.
Damn, Avery. When's the funeral?
You're 44 and you had a slight heart attack. You're not exactly a vegetable.
The male nurse glided in and glared at Mitch. Visiting hours are over, sir. You need to leave.
Mitch jumped to his feet.
Yeah, sure.
He slapped Avery's feet and walked out.
See you in a couple of days.
Thanks for coming. Tell Abby I said hello.
The elevator was empty. Mitch pushed the button to the 16th floor and seconds later got off. He ran 2 flights of stairs to the 18th, caught his breath, and opened the door. Down the hall, away from the elevators, Rick Acklin watched and whispered into a dead telephone receiver. He nodded at Mitch, who walked toward him. Acklin pointed and Mitch stepped into a small area used as a waiting room by worried relatives. It was dark and empty, with 2 rows of folding chairs and a television that did not work. A Coke machine provided the only light. Terence sat next to it and flipped through an old magazine. He wore a sweatsuit, headband, navy socks, and white canvas sneakers. Terence, the jogger. Mitch sat next to him, facing the hall.
You're clean. They followed you from the office to the parking lot, then left.
Acklin's in the hall. Laney's around somewhere. Relax. I like the headband.
Thanks.
I see you got the message.
Obviously.
Real clever, McDear. I'm sitting at my desk this afternoon, minding my own business, trying to work on something other than the Bendini case.
I've got others, you know. And my secretary comes in and says there's a woman on the phone who wants to talk about a man named Marty Kaczynski. I jump from my chair, grab the phone, and of course it's your girl. She says it's urgent, as always. So I say, okay, let's talk. No, she don't play it. She makes me drop everything I'm doing, run over to the Peabody, go to the lounge, what's the name of it? Mallard's, and have a seat. So I'm sitting there thinking about how stupid this is, because our phones are clean. Damn it, Mitch, I know our phones are clean. We can talk on our phones. I'm drinking coffee, and the bartender walks over and asks if my name is Kaczynski. Kaczynski who? I ask. Just for fun. Since we're having a ball, right? Marty Kaczynski, he says, with a puzzled look on his face. I say, yeah, that's me. I felt stupid, Mitch. And he says I have a call. I walk over to the bar, and it's your girl. Tolar's had a heart attack or something, and you'll be here around 11. Real clever. Worked, didn't it? Yeah, and it would work just as easily if she would talk to me on my phone in my office. I like it better my way. It's safer. Besides, it gets you out of the office. Damn right it does. Me and three others. Look, Terrence, we'll do it my way, okay? It's my neck on the line, not yours. Yeah, yeah. What the hell are you driving? A rented Celebrity. Nice, huh? What happened to the little black lawyer's car? It had an insect problem. Full of bugs. I parked it at a mall Saturday night in Nashville and left the keys in it. Someone borrowed it. I love to sing, but I have a terrible voice. Ever since I could drive, I've done my singing in the car, alone. But with the bugs and all, I was too embarrassed to sing. I just got tired of it. Terrence could not resist a smile. That's pretty good, McDear. Pretty good. You should have seen Oliver Lambert this morning when I walked in and laid the police report on his desk. He stuttered and stammered and told me how sorry he was. I acted like I was real sad. Insurance will cover it, so old Oliver says they'll get me another one. Then he says they'll go get me a rental car for the meantime. I told him I already had one. Got it in Nashville Saturday night. He didn't like this because he knew it was insect-free. He calls the BMW dealer himself while I'm standing there to check on a new one for me. He asked me what color I wanted. I said I was tired of black and wanted a burgundy one with tan interior. I drove to the BMW place yesterday and looked around. I didn't see a burgundy of any model. He told the guy on the phone what I wanted, and then he tells him they don't have it. How about black, or navy, or gray, or red, or white? No, no, no. I want a burgundy one. They'll have to order it, he reports. Fine, I said. He hung up the phone and asked me if I was sure I couldn't use another color. Burgundy, I said. He wanted to argue, but realized it would seem foolish. So for the first time in 10 months, I can sing in my car. But a celebrity? For a hotshot tax lawyer? That's gotta hurt. I can deal with it. Terrence was still smiling, obviously impressed. I wonder what the boys in the chop shop will do when they strip it down and find all those bugs. Probably sell it to a pawn shop as stereo equipment. How much was it worth? Our boy said it was the best. 10-15 thousand. I don't know. That's funny. Two nurses walked by, talking loudly. They turned a corner and the hall was quiet. Acklin pretended to place another phone call. How's Tolar? Terrence asked. Superb. I hope my heart attack is as easy as his. He'll be here for a few days, then off for 2 months. Nothing serious. Can you get in his office?
Why should I? I've already copied everything in it.
Terence leaned closer and waited for more. No, I cannot get in his office. They've changed the locks on the third and fourth floors, and the basement.
How do you know this?
The girl, Terence. In the last week, she's been in every office in the building, including the basement. She's checked every door, pulled on every drawer, looked in every closet. She's read mail, looked at files, and rummaged through the garbage. There's not much garbage, really. The building has 10 paper shredders in it, 4 in the basement. Did you know that?
Terence listened intently and did not move a muscle.
How did she...
Don't ask, Terence, because I won't tell you.
She works there. She's a secretary or something. She's helping you from the inside.
Mitch shook his head in frustration. Brilliant, Terence. She called you twice today. Once at about 2:15 and then about an hour later. Now, how would a secretary make 2 calls to the FBI an hour apart?
Maybe she didn't work today. Maybe she called from home.
You're wrong, Terence, and quit guessing. Don't waste time worrying about her. She works for me, and together we'll deliver the goods to you.
What's in the basement?
1 big room with 12 cubicles, 12 busy desks, and 1,000 file cabinets. Electronically wired file cabinets. I think it's the operations center for their money laundering activities. On the walls of the cubicles, she noticed names and phone numbers of dozens of banks in the Caribbean. There's not much information lying around down there. They're very careful. There's a smaller room off to the side, heavily locked and full of computers larger than refrigerators.
Sounds like the place.
It is, but forget it. There's no way to get the stuff out without alerting them.
Impossible.
I know of only 1 way to bring the goods out.
Okay.
A search warrant.
Forget it. No probable cause.
Listen to me, Terence. This is how it's going to be, okay? I can't give you all the documents you want, but I can give you all you need. I have in my possession over 10,000 documents, and although I have not reviewed all of them, I've seen enough to know that if you had them, you could show them to a judge and get a search warrant for Front Street. You can take the records I have now and obtain indictments for maybe half the firm. But the same documents will get your search warrant and consequently a truckload of indictments. There's no other way to do it. Terence walked to the hall and looked around. Empty. He stretched his legs and walked to the Coke machine. He leaned on it and looked through the small window to the east.
Why only half the firm?
Initially, only half. Plus a number of retired partners. Scattered through my documents are various names of partners who've set up the bogus Cayman companies with Meralto money. Those indictments will be easy. Once you have all the records, your conspiracy theory will fall in place and you can indict everyone.
Where did you get the documents?
I got lucky. Very lucky. I sort of figured the firm had more sense than to keep the Cayman bank records in this country. I had a hunch the records might be in the Caymans. Fortunately, I was right. We copied the documents in the Caymans.
We?
The girl, and a friend.
Where are the records now?
You and your questions, Terence. They're in my possession. That's all you need to know.
I want those documents from the basement.
Listen to me, Terence. Pay attention. The documents in the basement are not coming out until you go in with a search warrant. It is impossible. Do you hear?
Who are the guys in the basement?
Don't know. I've been there 10 months and never seen them. I don't know where they park or how they get in and out. They're invisible. I figure the partners and the boys in the basement do the dirty work.
What kind of equipment is down there?
2 copiers, 4 shredders, high-speed printers and all those computers. State-of-the-art.
Terence walked to the window, obviously deep in thought.
That makes sense.
Makes a lot of sense.
I've always wondered how the firm, with all those secretaries and clerks and paralegals, could maintain such secrecy about Moralto.
It's easy.
The secretaries and clerks and paralegals know nothing about it.
They're kept busy with the real clients.
The partners and senior associates sit in their big offices and dream up exotic ways to launder money, and the basement crew does the grunt work.
It's a great setup.
So there are plenty of legitimate clients?
Hundreds.
They're talented lawyers with an amazing clientele.
It's a great cover.
And you're telling me, McDare, that you've got the documents now to support indictments and search warrants. You've got them. They're in your possession.
That's what I said.
In this country?
Yes, Terence, the documents are in this country.
Very close to here, actually.
Terence was fidgety now. He rocked from 1 foot to the other and cracked his knuckles. He was breathing quickly.
What else can you get out of Front Street?
Nothing. It's too dangerous. They've changed the locks, and that sort of worries me.
I mean, why would they change the locks on the 3rd and 4th floors and not on the 1st and 2nd?
I made some copies on the 4th floor 2 weeks ago, and I don't think it was a good idea. I'm getting bad vibes.
No more records from Front Street.
What about the girl?
She no longer has access.
Terence chewed his fingernails, rocking back and forth, still staring at the window.
I want the records, McDear, and I want them real soon, like tomorrow.
When does Ray get his walking papers?
Today's Monday. I think it's set up for tomorrow night. You wouldn't believe the cussing I've taken from Voiles. He's had to pull every string in the book.
You think I'm kidding?
He called in both senators from Tennessee, and they personally flew to Nashville to visit the governor.
Oh, I've been cussed, McDear. All because of your brother.
He appreciates it.
What's he gonna do when he gets out?
I'll take care of that. You just get him out.
No guarantees. If he gets hurt, it ain't our fault.
Mitch stood and looked at his watch.
Gotta run. I'm sure someone's out there waiting for me.
When do we meet again?
She'll call. Just do as she says.
Oh, come on, Mitch. Not that routine again. She can talk to me on my phone, I swear. We keep our lines clean. Please, not that again.
What's your mother's name, Terence?
What?
Doris.
Doris?
Yeah, Doris.
Small world.
We can't use Doris. Whom did you take to your senior prom?
I don't think I went.
I'm not surprised. Who was your first date, if you had one?
Mary Alice Brenner.
She was hot, too. She wanted me.
I'm sure.
My girl's name is Mary Alice. The next time Mary Alice calls, you do exactly as she says, okay?
I can't wait.
Do me a favor, Terence.
I think Tolar's faking, and I've got a weird feeling his fake heart attack is somehow related to me. Get your boys to snoop around here and check out his alleged heart attack.
Sure.
We have little else to do.
Chapter 33. Tuesday morning, the office buzzed with concern for Avery Tolar. He was doing fine. Running tests. No permanent damage. Overworked. Stressed out. CAPS did it. Divorce did it. Leave of absence. Nina brought a stack of letters to be signed. Mr. Lambert would like to see you if you're not too busy. He just called.
Fine. I'm supposed to meet Frank Mulholland at 10. Do you know that?
Of course I know that. I'm the secretary. I know everything.
Your office or his?
Mitch looked at his appointment book and pretended to search. Mulholland's office, in the Cotton Exchange building.
His, he said with a frown.
You met there last time, didn't you? Didn't they teach you about turf in law school? Never, I repeat, never meet two times in a row on the adversary's turf. It's unprofessional. It's uncool. Shows weakness.
How can you ever forgive me? Wait till I tell the other girls. They all think you're so cute and macho. When I tell them you're a wimp, they'll be shocked.
They need to be shocked with a cattle prod.
How's Abby's mother?
Much better. I'm going up this weekend.
She picked up two files.
Lambert's waiting.
Oliver Lambert pointed at the stiff sofa and offered coffee. He sat perfectly erect in a wing chair and held his cup like a British aristocrat.
I'm worried about Avery, he said.
I saw him last night, Mitch said. Doctor's forcing a 2-month retirement.
Yes, that's why you're here. I want you to work with Victor Milligan for the next 2 months. He'll get most of Avery's files, so it's familiar territory.
That's fine. Victor and I are good friends.
You'll learn a lot from him. A genius at taxation. Reads 2 books a day.
Great, thought Mitch. He should average 10 a day in prison.
Yes, he's a very smart man. He's helped me out of a jam or two.
Good. I think you'll get along fine. Try and see him sometime this morning.
Now, Avery had some unfinished business in the Caymans. He goes there a lot, as you know, to meet with certain bankers. In fact, he was scheduled to leave tomorrow for a couple of days. He told me this morning you're familiar with the clients and the accounts, so we need you to go.
The Lear, the loot, the condo, the storage room, the accounts. 1,000 thoughts flashed in his mind. It did not add up.
The Caymans? Tomorrow?
Yes, it's quite urgent. 3 of his clients are in dire need of summaries of their accounts and other legal work. I wanted Milligan to go, but he's due in Denver in the morning.
Avery said you could handle it.
Sure, I can handle it.
Fine. The Lear will take you. You'll leave around noon and return by commercial flight late Friday.
Any problems?
Yes, many problems. Ray was leaving prison. Terrence was demanding the contraband. $500,000 had to be collected, and he was scheduled to disappear any time.
No problems.
He walked to his office and locked the door. He kicked off his shoes, lay on the floor, and closed his eyes. The elevator stopped on the 7th floor, and Mitch bolted up the stairs to the 9th. Tammy opened the door and locked it behind him. He walked to the window.
"Were you watching?" he asked.
"Of course. The guard by your parking lot stood on the sidewalk and watched you walk here."
"Wonderful. Even Dutch follows me."
He turned and inspected her.
"You look tired."
"Tired? I'm dead. In the past 3 weeks, I've been a janitor, a secretary,
a lawyer, a banker, a whore, a courier, and a private investigator.